Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to New Books and Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Klobas, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Carl Rawlison, the author of a new biography of William Faulkner entitled The Life of William Faulkner, The Past is Never Dead, 1897 to 1934. Carl, welcome to the New Books Network.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
We're happy to have you on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Sure. One thing you have to know is that I'm a professional biographer. I put it that way because sometimes a writer will do a biography because he or she is interested in a particular subject. I'm actually interested certainly in particular subjects, but in the whole sort of field of biography, I've written books about biography. I've got a book called A Higher Form of Cannibalism, Adventures in the Art and Politics of Biography. It's something, the higher form of cannibalism part comes from Rudyard Kipling. There are all kinds of sort of negative stereotypes of what biographers do in terms of following around their figures almost like they're vampires. So I have a lot of fun with that in the various books I've written about biography, including one called Biography, A User's Guide. So I've written about, my first biography was of Marilyn Monroe. And I've done other film figures, movie stars, Dana Andrews, and a great character actor, Walter Brennan. And I've written about film extensively. I've written about a number of women figures, Martha Gellhorn, a journalist and also a novelist. And some people know her best as Ernest Hemingway's third wife and the only woman to have walked out on him. Then there's also Rebecca West, a wonderful English prose writer. Author of a great travel book, Black Lamb and Gray Falcon, about her trip through the Balkans, through what was then Yugoslavia. And lesser-known figures like Joe Craigie, a British filmmaker, a British politician, her husband Michael Foot, I did separate biographies of them. So it's a whole range of subjects, the poet Amy Lowell, and also Sylvia Plath. Actually, I've done two biographies of Plath. The second one is The Last Days of Sylvia Plath, which it came out at almost at the same time as this Faulkner biography, in which I really attempt to go into the last days of her life. So I'm very active. I'm a member of the Biographers International Organization. And actually, I've just started a podcast called A Life in Biography, which is about my two most recent books on Plath and Faulkner, but it's more generally about why people read biographies, what really goes on in the biographer's mind, how you put a book together, dealing with people's reactions, reviews of biographies, and so on. For several years, I wrote a column on biography for the newspaper New York Sun. So that gives you sort of a rundown of the range of my interests and how really closely focused I am on biography and even the history of biography.
I really like your approach to biography in the Faulkner book because so many biographies tend to have they focus upon the person's life. And what you've done in it is that you've done a lot to, you set up the historical context, but you also try to integrate what we know of Faulkner through his writings into it, not just the, you know, the letters and the nonfiction material, yes, but the fiction as well.
Yes, I could give you a good example of that. I consider his greatest work, and many people think it's his most difficult novel. It's called Absalom, Absalom. It's actually from a passage in the Bible about a father and his son and the tragedy involving them. And he sort of transforms this into a story of the Civil War South and how a father rejects his son, partly because of his blood, really, that he's of mixed parentage, black and white. It's one of Faulkner's most profound statements on race. And I got very interested in how he put that novel together and what that novel meant to him. After all, that's what biographers try to do. They try to understand the roots, the origins of in this case, a writer's work. And one of the things that's really curious about Absalom, Absalom is that a good part of it is not set in the South. Faulkner is known certainly as a Southern novelist, and his series of novels called the Yaknapatawpha series, which is set in his mythical county, very closely connected to the actual town he lived in, Oxford, Mississippi. But in his novel, Absalom, Absalom, a good part of it is set in Harvard. And when Faulkner wrote the novel, he had certainly been in the Northeast, but he didn't know Harvard well. He knew Yale very well, but not Harvard. And I kept thinking about, well, why didn't he put it in Yale? Yale is a prestigious college. You could easily have part of it set at Yale. Two college roommates who were thinking about this, you know, story of Thomas Sutpen and his sons and what happens to them during the Civil War. Why does he do it in Harvard? And then as I got into the biography itself, Faulkner spent part of his very early apprenticeship years as a writer in New Orleans, including one very six-month intense period. Well, who does he make friends with? He makes friends with a number of Northerners. Where are these Northerners educated? Harvard. That began to unlock certain things about Faulkner's mentality and sensitivity, because one of his greatest characters, Quentin Compson, goes to Harvard, and he's the one who's helping to tell this story in Absalom, Absalom. And then it's even more curious that the person that Quentin is telling his story to is a Canadian roommate named Shreve McCannon. Well, partly Faulkner was drawing on his own experience. He trained in the RAF in Toronto, Canada, during the First World War and got to know a lot of Canadians. But it's more than that. It's a combination of Faulkner's experiences in New Orleans and in the South, particularly in New Orleans, because he met one particular man who was educated at Harvard. His name is Oliver Lafarge. Lafarge was an anthropologist, and he was also a novelist. And if you look at the way Faulkner writes Absalom, Absalom, you might almost call it an anthropological novel, because it really deals with the whole issue of ethnicity and race almost from a global anthropological perspective. But it's even more than that. When you look at Shreve, he's got these moon-shaped glasses, spectacles. That's what Oliver Lafarge had. I don't think any biographer has ever connected all these things together. That's the kind of thing that just sends a biographer like me into ecstasy, when you begin to see that all what seem to be all these disparate elements of a person's life, how he could put all that together in one book.
And how you need to understand the life to see where all these elements in his novels and other works are coming from.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And you begin to understand, well, why is a certain novel structured the way it is? Why does it shift between the South and the North? Well, Faulkner, when he was very young, just about 20 years old, followed a friend of his, Phil Stone, up to Yale. And people started reacting to Faulkner. He had never been out of the South. He had never been out of his town, Oxford, Mississippi. And they thought, you know, his Southern drawl, he had a very soft Southern drawl. He was kind of hard to understand. And he was treated really as a kind of foreigner. Well, again, this leads me to another one of Faulkner's greatest novels, The Sound and the Fury. in which, again, one of his greatest characters, Quentin Compson, he's both in The Sound of the Fury and in Absalom, Absalom. Quentin is walking around Cambridge, Cambridge, Massachusetts, where Harvard is. He's walking around Cambridge, and he meets this little Italian girl who's lost. And he takes her hand, and they walk around Cambridge together, and he goes into a baker shop, and this woman is muttering about foreigners. And there's a whole theme in The Sound of the Fury about sort of nativist America and foreigners. And Faulkner has such compassion the way he writes this scene with the little girl. And I began to think about, well, he knows about this because he himself was treated as a kind of foreigner. You know, people would say that again, Bill, because, you know, they didn't understand it, but they were also sort of charmed by his Southern dialect and were trying to understand it. So I think he had that kind of, he had this empathy for people that were different from himself. And he himself grew up in the South. His great-grandfather had served in the Civil War, had been a Civil War hero. There were these generations of Faulkner with this military tradition and this sort of traditionalist view of everything. And he grew up in that. And yet, as he emerges as a young adult and becomes interested in poetry and interested in writing and then has these experiences in other places, in Yale and New York City and Toronto, and ultimately goes to Italy and England and France as a young man, all of these things begin to give him a worldview of his hometown.
What led you to write a biography of William Faulkner?
It goes way, way back. I first read William Faulkner in high school. We're going back to the early 1960s. And was enchanted with The Sound of the Fury, although I have to admit, I don't think I understood much of it. There was something about the way he treated human characters, human identity, that really, the contrast in brothers like Quentin, who's very cerebral, and his brother Jason, who's very talkative and very, thinks he's very realistic and practical and so on. And I got very interested in that. I took Southern Literature as an undergraduate at Michigan State University, and then did my dissertation. It was finished in 1975 with a great Faulkner scholar, Michael Milgate, and that became my first book in 1984. I never thought then that I was going to do a biography of Faulkner. I thought I would simply be a literature scholar, but I got interested in biography, did many, many other subjects. And I was coming sort of toward the end of my teaching career about, six, 7 years ago. And I decided, in a sense, to come back to my first love, to go full circle and do a biography of Faulkner. There was one other motivating factor. Around 2005, a Faulkner biography came out. And by that time, I had written several biographies. And I reviewed this biography for the New York Sun. And I gave it sort of a mixed review. And that's when I really began to think, you know, there's another way to do a Faulkner biography. That's another thing that people, I think, need to know about biography. They think of it as the story of someone's life, and certainly it is. But often, especially if the figure has been done before, like Marilyn Monroe, one of my subjects, or like William Faulkner, there have been, you know, half a dozen major biographies of Faulkner. Someone might say, well, why on earth would you have to write another one? We know his story. And my point is that I read all those biographies and reviewed the latest ones and realized there were certain key elements, certain things in Faulkner's life that biographers had not covered. And with my own experience in Hollywood, for example, Faulkner spent off and on over a 20-year period, he spent probably the equivalent of 4 years in Hollywood. So that was one thing that really got me interested, because I felt I knew things about film production. I knew things about screenwriting. I had contacts in California. I knew where archives were that I was sure I would find new material on Faulkner. All that was part of it. Other aspects of these biographies that I thought needed, in a sense, fixing or refurbishing were, for instance, Faulkner's wife. She's in those biographies, but she doesn't come alive as a person. And it's important because she also wrote, and some of what she wrote had an impact on Faulkner. So all of these elements about his own family life, and the other thing that I found out about him that is mentioned in the other biographies, but is a much bigger story in my life, is what a family man. Of all modern novelists, I'd say Faulkner is the greatest family man, with an extended family of cousins and nephews and nieces, many of whom he financially supported, even while he was writing these great works of literature and taking these trips to Hollywood. I discovered the diary and letters of his stepson, Malcolm Franklin. I found similar kinds of documents written by family members that made an enormous difference. I deal with his wife Estelle's letters and her description of Faulkner, which I think give you a very different view of him than, you know, his male companions and the people he worked with. So there were a lot of factors that went into it. And I must say, once I began to do the research, it was just exhilarating. I'll tell you one brief story. There was a Faulkner biographer, Carvel Collins, who began a biography of William Faulkner in 1948. And he died in 1990, never having written a word of the biography. But he collected an enormous amount of material. He interviewed Faulkner's mother. He interviewed Faulkner. He interviewed Faulkner's brother. Faulkner, when he would come to New York to see his publishers at Random House, would stay in the Algonquin Hotel. Well, Carvel Collins went and he interviewed the staff of the Algonquin Hotel, and he had transcripts of all these interviews, and they had been sitting in his collection at the University of Texas for decades. And for some reason, the other Faulkner biographers never went through what turned out to be 105 boxes of material. So it was like having someone else's biography, never having been published, as kind of part of the raw material of my biography. So it became, you know, quite an extensive enterprise. I originally had projected one volume, and one of the reasons there are two volumes is in order to really understand Faulkner as a writer and as a human being, you need that links. I think his life stands up to that kind of treatment.
You mentioned that Faulkner was very much of a family man, and family is a major theme in his literature. You also,
oh, yeah.
So it makes sense that you start your biography by looking at Faulkner's family background. What was Faulkner's family like? What were his ancestors like, and how did that inform our understanding of his fiction?
Right. Well, growing up, William Faulkner kept hearing these stories about his great-grandfather, William Faulkner, who actually spelled his name without the U, F-A-L-K-N-E-R. And you can see not only photographs in my book, but I've done a book trailer that's on YouTube in which you see the huge statue in the Ripley, Mississippi town, in the cemetery, this towering statue of Colonel William Cuthbert Faulkner, who was this sort of looming presence in his great-grandson's life. None of the other generations had sort of matched what the great-grandfather had done, because not only had he distinguished himself in the Civil War, He also was a novelist. He wrote a novel called The White Rose of Memphis that went through like 40 editions well after Colonel Faulkner died. It was a very popular novel set on a Mississippi riverboat. And Faulkner grew up saying things like, I'd like to write like my great-grandpappy. So that was really a dominating presence, but just as important in terms of aesthetics, in terms of an interest in art, was Faulkner's mother, Maud. Maud was a painter, and she painted not just members of her family, she painted their black servants, one of whom, Caroline Barr, was essentially Faulkner's nursemaid. Faulkner grew up listening to Caroline Barr's stories about Reconstruction. And while the white people would talk about things like, oh, what a terrible tragedy it was that we had these black governments during Reconstruction, Caroline Barr would tell them about how Black people were terrorized by white people during Reconstruction. And you can see these two heritages, in a sense, not really competing, but complementing each other in Faulkner's novels. There's one Faulkner novel, The Unvanquished, which is actually set during the Civil War. And you can see there both the white and the Black perspectives. You see the young son, Bayard Sartorius, who, you know, worships his father, the colonel, who's very much modeled after after Faulkner's great-grandfather. And he's got a companion, a Black companion named Ringo. And they're playing a Civil War game. They're playing as if it's the Battle of Vicksburg. And one of the slaves comes in. His name is Lush, and he kicks over their toy soldiers, the little mud patch that they were turning into the Mississippi River, and essentially tells them, you know, that the South is losing. He doesn't use those words, but in effect, he's saying by destroying the game that you're really losing the war. And they're lionizing the slave master, Colonel Sartorius, and Lush, in a sense, has more information than the whites that these boys are growing up with. At least he's more attuned to what's happening. It's interesting because about a couple years ago, I reviewed a biography of General Sherman and about his march through the South and into Georgia. And, you know, one of the things that Sherman relied on and much more than some of the other Civil War generals, he relied on Black people. He relied on slaves who provided him with intelligence about, you know, where to look for these Confederates. And Faulkner knew these things by listening to Caroline Barr. So he had a very rich heritage, both historical and literary. His mother was a great reader. His mother was really quite something. When she died on her bedroom table next to her bed was a copy of D.H. Lawrence's novel Lady Chatterley's Lover. So for someone of her generation to have those kinds of interests, in other words, she had a sense of not just the Southern heritage, but of raising a child, and he was the only... He had other brothers, but he was the only child with these kinds of literary and aesthetic interests. She had a sense of his greatness that really no one else in the family really understood, certainly not his father, who loved to read, you know, Zane Grey, Western stories, shoot 'em ups, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I was really surprised by it was interesting to see how you integrated The Virginian by Owen Whistler this understanding of Faulkner's early life.
That's a continuing theme. The Virginian is the Southerner who is the epitome of the gentleman and how a gentleman should behave. And right through Faulkner's writing, there's a lot about the whole code of the gentleman. In fact, his last published novel, The Reavers, is all about that, about a young boy growing up to learn what the responsibilities of a gentleman are. So, and Faulkner carried himself that way. Once in Hollywood, there were some screenwriters talking about Faulkner, and he could be sort of aloof and very aristocratic looking and certainly not just one of the boys. And one woman sized to him, she said, you know, he's a professional Southerner. and that's, you know, what does that mean really? I think, you know, it's the code of the gentleman. It's what he got from the Virginian. And the thing about that is, it wasn't just him. Everybody in his family read the Virginian. Even his father read the Virginian. So it was just in the bones, in the blood.
And it was interesting, you mentioned how he's this professional Southerner where he's in places like Hollywood and New York as well. But it's by contrast, when he's growing up in Oxford, you describe how he's not really that part of that aristocratically. He's in the sense of being part of his family's not part of the town. You portray them in your book as sort of having, you know, fallen off a bit, that they're not quite as grand as they had once had been.
That's right. The Faulkners were still a prominent family, but it's a kind of, you know, like a shabby gentility. No one, as I was saying before, no one can sort of match the illustrious career of the colonel, who, by the way, is murdered by one of his business partners. So it was a very dramatic, even you might say melodramatic life, and nothing that his son or grandsons accomplished came anywhere near in terms of capturing the community's imagination. So William Faulkner growing up, really, it took him a long time to appreciate his father at all. His father didn't think much of him, and he tried to just stay out of his father's way. So he became a kind of alienated figure in some ways in Oxford. And that's one of the reasons why the young girl he fell in love with, Estelle Oldham, became so important to him, because she also was a great reader. She was, by her teens, she was reading people like Joseph Conrad, and so was William Faulkner. So they had a great deal in common and formed a kind of bond that was really important to him. And then when her family wanted her to marry well, and marrying a Faulkner might have been marrying well if William Faulkner had behaved like the eldest son of a distinguished family. That is, if he had had a profession, if he had, you know, he didn't finish high school, he didn't seem to want to settle down. And so the family looked around and they found this fellow, Cornell Franklin, who was an attorney and who did have a distinguished career, who took Estelle off to the Far East, really for a while, devastating William Faulkner, because that's the girl he thought he was going to marry. At one point, she even said, "Why don't we just run off?" And he said, "No, no, why not?" Well, because he was a gentleman. Gentlemen don't do those sorts of things. They don't overthrow family traditions like that. So that's part of what makes him such a fascinating figure, because in some ways he's so traditional, he's so conservative. In other ways, he's so radical and doesn't want to fit into the conventions of society.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
There's an element of artifice as well. And I was thinking that really stands out, especially when you get into his war service, because the contrast you have between what you uncover about his actual war service versus how you describe his portrayal of it when he comes back and is parading around Oxford in his RAF uniform.
it's very funny. You know, the thing I learned, I don't think this is in the other biographies, I didn't realize that before he went north and then to Canada to sign up in the RAF, he had, like Hemingway, he wanted to be sort of an ambulance driver. Dos Passos had done this too. The novelists of that generation, Archibald MacLeish, poet, many of them went abroad before the U.S. entered the First World War. After all, the U.S. didn't enter it until 1917, and the First World War starts in August 1914. And he wanted to, like many young men of his generation, he wanted to be part of the action. And so he wanted to be an ambulance driver too, and his mother just wouldn't let him. She said, you know, you're too young, you can't do that. And then, so what does he do? With his friend Phil Stone, they go up first to Yale, where Stone is studying for a law degree, and then they make it over to Canada, and Faulkner's just, it's a complete fiction. He even, in his application for the IRF, says he was born in England in a village named Finchley. It's just utterly, you know, made up. And he trains in flight school. We have drawings of airplanes that he made, and he was going through the training. But the war ended before he even took his first flight. But he writes a letter home, and he says, you know, I'm so excited. I had my first flight today. It was complete fiction. It never happened. And then he comes home, and he's got a cane. He tells some people he's got a plate in his head. You know, that he's been wounded. He's a wounded warrior. And it's interesting. There are some people in Oxford, his hometown, who seem to accept the stories. But there are others, a good friend of his, Ben Wasson's, who became his first literary agent, said, oh, we knew this, that's what Bill was like. You know, he would make up these stories. We never believed that he was actually in the war and flew planes and, you know, crashed a plane in France and so on. But, and he was still doing this in the 1920s in New Orleans, and, you know, 1925, he was telling people. And even later than that, when he went to Hollywood, he had this lover, Meta Carpenter, and he woke up one night in sweats, and she said, what's wrong? And he say, oh, you know, I was reliving my war experiences. Well, he didn't have any war experiences.
It makes me wonder the degree to which he started to sort of internalize his own, you know, fictional account of being in the war.
Well, that's it. When you read his war stories, and even veterans, he had a Hollywood screenwriter, Lawrence Stallings, who had been in the war, who lost a leg in the war. And when he read Faulkner, it seemed so authentic to him that he never questioned it. He thought Faulkner had, you know, had seen active service just like he had. And when you read some of the Faulkner, like many young men of his age, World War I age, were fascinated with airplanes. I mean, Faulkner knew all the mechanics of how you did fly a plane, even though he never actually literally flew one. He did take flying lessons later in the early 30s and did learn how to fly a plane. And actually, he wasn't all that good at it, but he did learn how to fly. But when you read his stories, you could easily think that, yeah, this man really was in the war.
So how does he develop as a writer? Because you describe how it's almost as soon as the war is over and he's discharged, he's beginning this process of trying to get published, initially poetry, yeah, and then other works. How does he transition into this, and where does this come from, his impulse, his drive into writing?
Well, it starts at a very early age. There are notebooks from when he was like 7, 8 years old. He had quite an ability to draw. I think his mother encouraged this. He was always observing things. His father was just... because the grandfather owned a railroad, Faulkner's father was just absolutely obsessed with trains, and worked for the railroad. And some of Faulkner's earliest drawings are about trains, for example, before he got interested in planes. And so, part of that literary impulse is family-inspired, particularly from his mother. Her mother also had an artistic sensibility, so that's encouraged on the maternal side of the family. Then the mother is searching, because there weren't very many people in Oxford who could teach this young boy much about art. Phil Stone, this fellow he was an attorney who Faulkner accompanied to Yale, is the one that starts to give him books, to talk to him about writing, about how there's this bigger world of literature. And that's what really gets Faulkner started. And like a lot of young writers, he begins as a poet. And his poetry is never first rate, and he goes on with it for several years. And what happens, the way he makes the transition really to prose, is when he gets to New Orleans and he meets the writer Sherwood Anderson. And he starts reading Anderson's stories, and a bond is formed between the two men. They both had a great love of horses. And Anderson, though he wasn't a Southerner, he was a Midwesterner, he spent a lot of time around stables. Well, Faulkner's father owned a stable. Faulkner knew a lot about horses and loved horses. And so, Anderson had even written a book called Horses and Men. And so they get to talking, and Anderson puts Faulkner in a story as a character named David. The story is called The Meeting South. And then it becomes sort of reciprocal. They start telling tall tales about this character named L. Jackson, who lives in a Louisiana swamp. And that's when, through this letter writing and this exchange of tales through letters, I think Faulkner begins to see the virtues of prose and that he's pretty good at it. And then he finds out that he can write these stories for a New Orleans newspaper, sort of sketches, kind of thing that Stephen Crane did as a young writer too. And he could get $10 a sketch, which in 1925 New Orleans was quite a lot of money for this young man. And that's what begins him on the road to prose and to his first novel, Soldier's Pay, which is about a returning war veteran who's going to die. It's pretty clear. His injuries are so bad. He's really been blinded and his nervous system is shot. And again, if you read Soldier's Pay, the film director Howard Hawks read it. He fell in love with Faulkner because he just found it so authentic.
So how quickly does he emerge as a writer? I mean, are his early books successful? Does he have difficulty getting attention, or is he a success from the start? Does he do all those early connections with people like Anderson help him out?
The connections help him get publishers. The Soldier's Pay is well reviewed. It gets a lot of positive reviews. The second novel, Mosquitoes, not quite so good, although it's set in New Orleans. He becomes certainly not a popular or best-selling writer by any means. What happens is he establishes this enormous reputation among other writers in the literary community and among publishers in New York. Beginning at around 1930, this is after The Sound of the Fury is published and the As I Lay Dying is coming out, he's met a fellow named Harrison Smith, who's a publisher, who lends Faulkner money, who encourages him, who knows that Faulkner's books are not going to make a lot of money, that they're sort of experimental, it's going to be difficult. He has a lot of friends who have a lot of faith in him, that on the face of it, someone could look at it and say, this guy's just not going to make it. You know, he may have some kind of minor reputation among the literati, but he's never really going to amount to that much in the eyes of the world, let's say. And that's when Faulkner makes a really key decision. He decides, well, I'm going to show him. And he writes this novel, Sanctuary, which is, you know, it's a gangster story. It comes out just at the time that Edward G. Robinson is in Little Caesar. In other words, the timing is fabulous. James Cagney is doing a gangster film, Public Enemy. By 1932, Faulkner is in New York, and he's a celebrity. He's a big shot. Sanctuary sells more than all of his previous books combined. And that's when he first gets the attention of the movies. Because remember, you know, 1930, 31, 32, the movies are just beginning to talk. We're just coming out of the silent era. And they're looking for writers. Hollywood is looking for writers to do scripts. They really need playwrights, novelists, whoever can make it out to California. And here Faulkner's done this sensationalist novel about, you know, this Southern girl, Temple Drake, who gets involved with this gangster named Popeye, who rapes her with a corn cob. I mean, this was just shocking for contemporary life then, that kind of book. Faulkner became not famous, really, but infamous.
You mentioned something else here that in the book that I hadn't really appreciated, which was that he's also emerging at a time when writers had a greater stature in the country than they do today. And I thought that was a really fascinating point about how he is not just a writer, he is a literary celebrity, because at that time there were things like literary celebrities.
Writing meant something different then. The writer Norman Mailer said, this was already 20 years ago, he said, you know, novelists just don't count for much anymore. People read them. But I mean, for instance, Rebecca West, one of my other biographical subjects, made her first trip to America in 1923. She sailed, you know, she took a boat. And when she docked in Manhattan, there was a whole fleet of reporters waiting to interview her. Can you imagine that happening now? That gives you some sense of how different it was, how a writer could be a star. You know, there's just, how many writers could we mention that just anybody in the street, if you said mention the name, it would have to be maybe Stephen King, I suppose.
That was the name that came to my mind, too.
most people would probably, and the woman who wrote Harry Potter.
J.K. Rowling, George R.R. Martin, but I mean, you think about how they're tied to properties
about,
now.
Right. That's about, you know, that, you know, it has to be someone who's just mega successful. You know, if I went out on the street, you know, people may have heard of Faulkner because maybe he was taught in school. But the writer simply does not have a place in American culture now that a writer used to have. But I have to tell you, Faulkner was complaining that the writer didn't have a big enough place when he was alive. So it's all relative, of course. But now it's become, you know, so different. There aren't as many reviews in newspapers. You know, I'll be lucky with my William Faulkner biography if three or four major newspapers review it. Well, in Faulkner's time, when he came out with a novel or, you know, an important biography, it would get reviewed in hundreds of papers all over the country. You know, it was the print media was, you know, one of my other subjects, Amy Lowell, was a poet. She was reviewed, you know, by a newspaper in Sheboygan in Illinois. You know, stories about her would get into the local press. Nothing, you know, can happen. Like, you know, the only prayer a writer would have now is what I'm doing, to try to get a social media following on Facebook or Twitter, things like that. So it was completely different in Faulkner's day. Even if a writer like Sanctuary was considered a huge success, well, it was sold about 10,000 copies. That doesn't sound like a lot of copies, and it certainly isn't today. But then that was pretty good. You know, it wasn't, he wasn't Zane Grey. He wasn't, you know, doing hundreds of thousands of copies sold. But he was a force. You know, there would be articles about him in the Brooklyn Eagle, in newspapers like that, in the New York Times. So, yeah, it was quite a different world.
So how does his growing fame, his stature as a writer, affect his personal life? This is the period where he marries Estelle. What is he doing with his success?
He's spending every time he gets. He's not a good saver. He buys this dilapidated, it's a little misleading to call it a mansion, because it wasn't a big plantation home, but it was the home of an Oxford, which you call a merchant prince, which he had to fix up because it had really gotten deteriorated. So he buys a home, takes out a mortgage, has his first and only child, Jill. Eventually, when he goes to Hollywood and makes some money, he buys an airplane. He's setting himself up as a kind of landed proprietor. His home is next to a woods called Bailey's Woods, because that used to be the owner of the woods. And he's slowly acquiring all the property around, because he doesn't want it to be subdivided. He doesn't want to be hemmed in by a housing development. So he's in some ways acting like a not exactly a prosperous citizen, but a landed gentleman in a way. He buys a farm, Greenfield Farm. He does all these kinds of things so that he spends so much money, and then his brother Dean dies in an air crash, and he supports Dean, the niece, who's named Dean after her father, and Dean's mother, and his brother John is not doing well, so he starts supporting him and puts him on the farm. And so the bills keep getting, you know, bigger and bigger and bigger. He goes into the local department store, and he says to the owner, he said, you know, you might get paid several months or a year from now. He said, I could just write you my autograph, and someday it's going to be more worth more than my bill here at the department store. And that the descendant of that owner has that letter framed in the in Nielsen's department store in the Oxford Square today.
I was thinking as I was reading this part of your book about how Faulkner really does during this period seem to be a man out of his time, because in addition to doing that, I mean, he's this great success during the Great Depression as more and more people are finding it difficult to make a living. And he's also, you wouldn't think there was a prohibition in place given how much he was drinking during this period as well.
Yeah. Well, during Prohibition, it was certainly not a law that was well observed. And he also, he drank corn liquor. He drank this stuff that was made in Southern stills. You know, there's a very funny picture of him in New Orleans with Sherwood Anderson, a drawing in which, you know, you see their table, and then below the table are all these 1 gallon jugs, you know, and they're full of corn liquor. And he would always introduce visitors from the north coming to Oxford to this corn liquor. But the funny thing about Faulkner was, on the one hand, he could act like a farmer and a yokel and pretend he didn't know anything, and then he could walk into a Hollywood restaurant like Musso and Frank, and, you know, order the best French wines, and he knew what he was doing. He knew what to order. Wonderful connoisseur of food, very sophisticated man, and yet wasn't interested in being in that world per se, and was really homesick when he was in Hollywood. But he gave a completely misleading impression, and other biographers have taken him at his word that he hated Hollywood. Well, there were aspects certainly that he hated, but he also had a very good time. He met some really interesting people. You know, he met all these emigres that were coming over from Nazi Germany. He had a woman that he was in love with who was involved in making movies with Howard Hawks. He had the enormous respect. It's very interesting, I found out at the studios. They looked out for him. You know, occasionally he would go on a drinking binge and they would protect him, you know, try to prevent him from getting fired. The interesting thing about Faulkner is there were always people, including Faulkner himself, who knew he was a great writer, and they treated him like that, like he was in a category all by himself. And it's quite astounding.
So you also mentioned how important his time in Hollywood is to him, for him financially. That is, whatever he's doing with his writing in terms of publishing short stories, his income from Hollywood really dwarfs it. What exactly is he doing as a writer in Hollywood? Was he producing, and how much of his work is actually making it onto the screen during this period?
Yeah, like a lot of screenwriters, he wrote a great deal, great many scripts. He probably worked on at least 50 projects, and not more than a dozen of those were ever really produced. And his name wasn't even on some of the projects that was produced for all sorts of reasons. Sometimes reasons of the union, and sometimes machinations at the studio, and so on. But he wrote some wonderful scripts, and probably his two greatest successes are a film that Hawks did with Humphrey Bogart and Lorne Bacall, To Have and Have Not, and also with Howard Hawks, The Big Sleep, which was based on Raymond Chandler's novel. Those are wonderful novels. The interesting thing about Faulkner is, even though he could seem so aloof, he was wonderful to collaborate with. For instance, on The Big Sleep, he collaborated with a woman, Lee Brackett, and she said he was just one. He'd come in and he'd say, all right, I got this blocked out, and I'm going to do these scenes, and how about you doing those scenes? And she had written a detective novel. And in fact, when Hawks hired her, he hadn't seen her when he wrote her a letter and asked her to be in the film. And he didn't know Lee was a she. He thought it was a he. But Hawks was fine with working with women. And so was Faulkner. Faulkner actually learned a great deal in terms of what he put into his women characters from working in Hollywood. So sometimes he was called in to do a whole script. And there are several whole scripts that I write about in my biography, both in the first and the second line. And sometimes he was called in to do a scene. Hawks did this very popular film called Air Force. And a very distinguished screenwriter, Dudley Nichols, had done a death scene that took place on a plane, and Hawks didn't like it. He thought it was too sentimental. And he went to Faulkner. And Faulkner, the other thing about Faulkner is he was fast, both as a novelist and as a screenwriter. He could write, and I'm not exaggerating, sometimes 10 times as fast as any other screenwriter. So he was almost like a made-to-order cook. And he went into this film, Air Force, and in a day wrote the death scene. And Hawks was so pleased. And Faulkner never, if you look at any of the recorded interviews, never acted as if any of this meant anything. But I found a letter to his son-in-law which said, you got to see Air Force. And by the way, I wrote this particular scene. Isn't it good? So Hollywood had its impact on him.
And yet, you mentioned how they esteemed him as a writer and that they protected him as a writer. And yet, you also explained that they didn't necessarily put him on a pedestal and take everything that he had done and try to preserve it. And I'm thinking that in here, in terms of the first film, which is the one that you focus on in this volume, which is yep. Today We Live, which I thought you had this fascinating description of the evolution of the movie in terms of in its early development before they started filming it.
Yes, that's right. It was based on a story of his, Turnabout, and it was all about men at war. It was about an American who was a flyer, a bomber, and about these Englishmen who did these now what the American Navy would call sort of PT boats. That would go up to German boats, really daring, and fire torpedoes at them and then have to turn around and hope not to be shot up themselves. And that was essentially Men at War story, and Faulkner wrote the screenplay, and Hawks said, wonderful. And they sent it to the producer, Irving Thalberg at MGM, who was the person. And he said, oh, this is wonderful. I'm not going to touch it. And then, a week later, whatever, Hawks comes to Faulkner and said, Thalberg just told me that Joan Crawford, she's the big star and they need to put her in a picture and it's going to have to be our picture. And Faulkner dryly said, I don't recall there being a woman on the story. But this is what I like about Faulkner is, unlike Scott Fitzgerald, who was very, I am the novelist, how dare you, tamper with what I've just written. I know better than anybody. Faulkner was not like that. When Hawks said that to him after, I think, Faulkner got off the initial shot, he met with Joan Crawford. He met with her, and she said, now, I want to be one of the boys. I want to talk like these men. I don't want this to be soft. This is a woman who's involved in the war and is working as a nurse in the war, and I want to be portrayed that way. And Faulkner did that, very much so. He wrote about her, and, he never talked about these things with anybody. But if you read one of his novels, The Wild Palms, which was published in 1929, there's a reference to Eisenstein, and there's a reference to Joan Crawford. And the reason for Crawford is because of Today We Live and his experience with her. And the reference to Eisenstein, Eisenstein wrote a play about a screenplay about the California Gold Rush, Sutter's Gold. And Howard Hawks gave Eisenstein's screenplay to Faulkner to rewrite. The idea of Faulkner rewriting Eisenstein. And the interesting thing is both scripts are great, and neither script was produced because it would have been very expensive to produce.
So when can we look forward to Volume 2?
Volume 2 is going to come out on Faulkner's birthday, September 25th. And there's even more about Hollywood and Faulkner's family. And one of the really interesting things, besides my dealing with films like The Have and Have Not and The Big Sleep, is what happens to Faulkner in Hollywood. He's asked to write a screenplay called Battle Cry, which Howard Hawks was to direct. And the reason that this was going to happen is, well, the war effort, obviously. It was going to have, part of it was set in China, part of it was set in France, part of it was set in the U.S., part of it was set in North Africa. It was going to cover every theater of the war. It was just incredibly, just colossal, tremendous. And I have both documented from Mita Carpenter, the woman that he was having an affair with, and also in a letter of his, how excited he was about this. It's a film that broke his heart because they wouldn't, again, they wouldn't make it because it was just going to be so expensive. The closest Hollywood ever came to it was Frank Capra, doing a series of documentaries called Why We Fight, which covered every theater of the war, every place. That changed Faulkner because it was almost like working on a government project. And when he won the Nobel Prize in 1950, his sense of himself as a world figure transformed him. And it appears in his writing. And the last part of the volume two is about that, how he actually became, and this is not an exaggeration, a diplomat, and behave like a diplomat. Now, many writers have gone on junkets for the United States as sort of goodwill ambassadors, but no one has behaved quite like a diplomat in the way that William Faulkner did. So I think people are going to be really surprised by that.
Well, I do look forward to reading it when it comes out, and I hope that when it does come out, we can also have you back to cover Volume 2 in another podcast.
Yeah, I'd love to do it.
Well, Carl Rawlinson, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
My pleasure. Thank you.